From RTE Radio, I'm Neil O'Sheridan. This is Playback Daily.
You're often with romantic comedies, it's the worst thing that can possibly happen to you, not being in a romantic relationship. And I wanted to be a little bit more positive about that.
So I knew that nobody would be able to pull in beside me and stop me getting in and out of the car like a rock star.
I just enjoy the singing, you know. I just enjoy singing and I enjoy the fun with the audience and the stage, and I just enjoy it.
Coming up on this special sunny Tuesday edition of Playback Daily, one day author David Nichols unveils his latest novel, How to Escape Your Giant Car When It's in a Tiny Parking Space, and how Daniel O'Donnell keeps things fresh. That's all on the way over the next hour of the Radio Catch-Up Show. That'll have to do a few stretches before standing up. Let's start with Oliver Callan musing on some upcoming oval ball game happening in Dublin next month.
Another thing people are fierce excited about is Leinster versus Northampton in the Champions Cup semi-final of the rugby thing, which is happening in Croke Park. It's happening in Croke Park because Lands End Road, Aviva Stadium, is out of action because they are upgrading it or doing whatever they're doing to prepare for the UEFA Europa League final on the 22nd of May. Remember, that was the one that was supposed to have Liverpool in until they flopped out of that in Jurgen Klopp's the end of his era. Didn't work out terribly well, but they came a cropper. They came well again in the Premier League over the weekend. But anyway, what am I talking about? Well, there's a lot of talk about Leinster going to Croke Park. It is totally sold out, so you're going to have 82,300 patrons, as they're sometimes known, heading to Croker. And people talk about the terrible atmosphere in the Aviva Stadium because people are getting up non-stop to drink throughout the entire match. Well, that won't be a problem because the Croke Park normal GA rules will be in place, and the organisers have said they're going to respect the normal GAA rules, which is, of course, that you cannot bring alcoholic drinks back to your seats throughout the match, so, or any at any stage. You can drink at the bars, of which there are many around Croke Park, in under the terraces, and the bars only open during the breaks between when there's no match play basically going on. That's the only time. So they're going to respect all of that, and that is going to be happening. It is there will be no getting up and down for your 14 pints and interrupting people who are there, and that is the number one reason for the crap atmosphere in Lansdowne. Along, of course, with the size, the large size of the corporate section in the Aviva Stadium relative to the steerage seats. Croke Park is much, much smaller because it's a big, big stadium. So we're looking forward to that. That's going to be in the May Bank holiday weekend. However, the articles around the place are also pointing out that there will unfortunately still be disruption for Dart users on this mega match day because they have scheduled engineering works over the weekend of the game. Dart service will not be operating between Grand Canal Dock and Bray. So basically, like from the entire south part of Dublin, which is all of Leinster fans, you would imagine, will not be able to use the Dart service from Bray to Grand Canal Dock on the bank holiday weekend, all weekend, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, May 4th, 5th and 6th. Dublin Bus and Go Ahead Ireland will accept the rail tickets on those services for the closed thing. And they said, look, we just have to do this on the bank holiday weekends because stuff has to get done along the Dart line. That's how it runs. And I wonder, will they look at that? Because 82,000 people is a lot of people moving around the city. And when you close down the only coastal rail line, there's fierce trouble indeed.
The tough life of a Leinster rugby supporter highlighted in stark fashion by Oliver Callan this morning. Meanwhile, actor Rebel Wilson has found herself in a spot of self-inflicted bother, apparently.
Now, Rebel Wilson, you must have great sympathy for Rebel Wilson. I know there's terrible things happening in the world, wars and so on, but don't forget all that. Rebel Wilson is the true victim because her new memoir is out, and as the reviews point out, she is very much looking for sympathy, inviting sympathy, and redacting things urgently from the memoir. So there's a great ruckus about Rebel Wilson, who is the star of the Pitch Perfect movies, hasn't done a whole lot else. You seem to know the name. She did a great speech, remember, BAFTA a couple of years ago, and she did appear very briefly in Bridesmaids. But anyway, she feels that she's lived enough to write a memoir in her 30s, and it was hyped as a tell-all. And in fact, she kind of can tell most of it now, because immediately she said she was going to name the premier a-hole in Hollywood, who turned out to be Sacha Baron Cohen, according to her telling. And she said she was forced to do terrible things on one of his terrible movies, which was called Grimsby. Said she was pressured to do a nude scene. She refused to do that. She said her experiences prompted her to adopt a no a-hole policy and decided deciding who she works with, and warned other people from working with him, and said that she was forced to do things that weren't in the script. Now, that led to him strongly denying her claims and people saying nobody in the crew would agree with her. And video footage was quietly released that appeared to debunk all of her claims. And then people started remembering in Australia, Rebel Wilson kind of made up stuff about her past before and had to claim, she falsely claimed that she was christened or named Rebel when she grew up, that she came from a very, very poor background. She was quite middle class in the end. And there is all of this unpleasantness now in Australia. They don't seem to be terribly enamoured with her. But her novel, or not her novel, her memoir, Freudian Slip, is getting a 2-star review here in The Telegraph. Hyped as a tell-all, saying, although she talks about being a gifted writer of comedy, the book does not substantiate this claim because, and she also boasts that audiences loved Bridesmaids, especially for her brief role in it. Melissa McCarthy might raise an eyebrow or a fist, it says here. And she said Pitch Perfect 2 was the most successful musical comedy film of all time. Although she later tries to say, well, she means comedies containing musical performances, not actual comedy musicals. And in Australia, she starred in a show called Pizza in the early noughties, which was her breakthrough role. And she said her role in the show was to be the big fat whale that got laughs, and that the atmosphere was akin to a special men's club. Instead, the creator of the show, his name is Fennec. Does he have a first name, Fennec? No, he's Australian, doesn't need a first name. Fennec says, "No thank you, no gratitude. It's hurtful and disgusting for us to hear this. I guess she'll do anything or say anything to sell a book. We gave her creative freedom that she needed, and we should have been thanked in the book rather than complained about her time on the show." Rebel Wilson, in her memoir, this is great tittle-tattle, come on now. Also has had a beef with Adele that nobody ever knew about, but they do know now. "Some actresses would get offended if I called them a plus size in this book, so I have to be careful with what I say," says Rebel. "This is why I think Adele hates me." And she claims Adele's alleged dislike of her stems from a time before Adele had lost weight and would get confused for Wilson. Did that happen? She says she encountered Adele at several events, only to have the star quickly turn away from poor Rebel Wilson. Very sad fate. Does Adele even know Rebel Wilson exists? You begin to wonder. But anyway, that's the tell-all gossip.
The beans, true or otherwise, spilled by Rebel Wilson in her memoir. But wait, there's more gossip to be had.
We're talking about Victoria Beckham, and she had a 50th birthday party and all that crack, and the Spice Girls reunited. The Spice Girls are now back to being the Spite Girls, however, because Mel B came out afterwards, was talking about the party and said it was epic. Victoria Beckham's 60th birthday yesterday, she was 50, to meeting competition winners, blah, blah, blah. And she also has a go at Jerry Horner. She's Jerry Horner because she's married to Christian Horner, a Formula One. Jerry Halliwell, we would have known her as in Spice Girl. Thing, and she says, "No one knows how old Ginger Spice is. Nobody's seen her passport. We've travelled the world together, but I still don't know how old she is. She claims she just had her 50th birthday, but I don't believe her." So that's apparently very important to Mel B to know. Mel B, does she say what age she is, importantly? She's 48. So she's kind of, it's one of those things where going, I'm slightly younger than you, so I'm going to call you old. But then again, Countess Markovic is smiling down at all of this. Indeed, dreadful.
The Spice Girls, eh? What have they done for us lately? Not like that nice Hozier fella carrying the flag for Irish music in 2024.
Now, Hozier, this is good news. Yes, this is good. This is good tittle-tattle. Hozier has become the fourth Irish artist ever to reach the number one spot in the American charts as the Billboard Hot 100, famous, revered, prestigious chart to be on. Surprising he's never been on it before. But anyway, he's only the fourth ever artist. The highest he ever did before, by the way, it's quite interesting, was Take Me to Church back in 2014, 2015, where he reached number two. And he never appeared on the chart since then. Basically, until he was a part of Noah Kahan's Northern Attitude remixed, a remix version, and he went up to 37 on it, but never appeared on it since, despite all the massive hits that he has over in this side of the world, until he released Too Sweet, which is incidentally not on his new album. It's called Too Sweet, and it is now number one. Billboard magazine said this is number one. It's officially, this will be the chart that will come out on Friday, but they're saying it is number one now, and he will have beaten none other than Kendrick Lamar A beast of the American Billboard Hot 100, of course. But who were the other artists to become number one? And they all date from the physical sales period, where people had to mosey down to the shop and buy the thing and handle it and read the sleeve notes and all of that. The true martyrs of music back in the day. So you go back to 1972 for the first Irish hit. That was Gilbert Sullivan from Waterford. And he did this song here. 1972, yeah, there's a tambourine in there. Number one. I promised myself to treat myself and visit. For 6 weeks, July 1972. Climbing to the top, will throw myself up in an effort to make clear to whoever what it's like when you're shattered. Get to the point, Gilbert O'Sullivan. In the lurch at a church where people were saying, my God, that's tough, she stood him up. Come on, get to the name of the song. Here he goes. Naturally. That was number one, 1972. Then after that, of course, let me get the dates here. U2 then, of course, they had two Hot 100, hot number ones in 1987. This is the first one. Yeah, this was when we conquered America. We fed them my auspicious feelings. Oh! Stood on a plug there that day in my bare feet. Oh! Beautiful falsetto. And then this was the other number one that same year. I'll turn that up a small bit there, yeah. This, of course, With or Without You, for those who don't know. This was May. Oh, so With or Without You was the first one. It did 3 weeks at number one in May 1987. And then August was I Still Haven't Found What I'm Looking For. And, of course, 1990, this legendary tune. Sinead had 4 weeks in the Billboard Hot 100. It's almost too sad to play the whole thing this stage, isn't it? It has a completely different meaning for us nowadays, of course. But Hozier, what a success this is. And it's quite interesting. They break it down into, it's about the streams, of course, that you get digitally. That's obviously enormous. But the radio airplay in America is very important. And there are just, there are a small number of physical sales still and digital sales as well. Vinyl, I suppose, would be the main physical sale nowadays. But congratulations to Hozier, who is in the new era of number ones in the Hot 100 for Too Sweet. That's
indeed. What a fine representative of Irish musichood. Well, let's put an end to the Oliver Callan monologue there before any more words get made up. Despite repeated highlighting in the media and assurances from government, delays for surgery for children with scoliosis remains a very significant issue. On this morning's Today with Claire Byrne, reporter Brian O'Connell spoke to one family in a particularly difficult situation, as he explained to Claire.
Liam is the youngest of four boys. He wanted to be a writer since he was seven, Claire, and his passions are art, music, writing. He uses technology to communicate through eye movement. He's in mainstream school and he hopes to attend first year in Killarney in September. And as I said, Liam has several complex conditions. Just over a year ago, his mum, Pam, noticed his spine was changing and she brought him for an assessment. I spoke with Pam yesterday and she told me first about her son, Liam.
He is an amazing little boy, just incredible. He has been through an awful lot in his life. At 3 months old, he was diagnosed with a life-threatening condition with no cure, just management. It's called glutaric aciduria type 1, and it's a metabolic condition. You can only manage it by diet, and then you just hope for the best. But what it means is that any illnesses, like minor illnesses, he's at risk of coma, stroke, or death. He also has epilepsy and dystonic cerebral palsy. He just faces everything with a smile on his face. He is in sixth class, although he hasn't been at school at all since before December.
One of the medical interventions that Liam is waiting on is spinal surgery because he has scoliosis. Is that correct?
That's correct. In November 2022, actually, he was checked by two senior physios and he was deemed to be straight. So in January and February, he was starting to be in a bit of pain, you know, like in the positioning of his wheelchair and different things like that. We kind of took it further and he ended up going for an X-ray in Cork. So a year ago, we were told that his spine was at 35 degrees on his first X-ray. we continued within that system with outpatient appointments, only to then have a follow-up x-ray in November, which then he was 85 degrees.
So this is rapid, aggressive.
Very aggressive, very.
And what impact was that having on Liam?
It was just horrendous. It was horrendous. It was just pain, just constant pain. Seating was an issue, having to go through the process of trying to get new seating, funding for seating, avail of the seating, and then 6 weeks later, 8 weeks later, trying to adjust the seating to him. But all the while, his spine was changing.
So that's Pam there. And as she said, that scoliosis that Liam has is rapid, Brian, and it really is impacting his day-to-day life.
Yes, the curvature in his spine is quite aggressive and it has added to the serious medical challenges Liam faces. It is impacting, as you can imagine, on his everyday life. And it's impacting as well, Claire, on his family's ability to keep him safe and healthy, as Pam explained.
It started becoming a little bit more difficult to feed him because he's orally fed at present. And his diet consists of level 4, which would be the equivalent of like kind of wet, warm Weetabix. So most of his foods come from a pharmacy and he's on a very strict diet, meaning everything he eats has to be weighed and measured. He was so grimaced. His face was so grimaced from pain that it was very difficult to get him to be able to kind of control those mouth muscles, his, you know, the esophagus, all of that seemed to be affected by it.
And all the while, did you ever get a date for surgery?
Basically, when it came to November 2023, that was when we got our next x-ray, which said 85 degrees. So when we had the appointment in December with our spinal team, it became evident that he needed surgery urgently.
So we're now into April. Has he had his surgery?
No, he hasn't had surgery.
Have you got a date for surgery?
I've no date for surgery.
Will you tell me where you are at the moment?
I am in Tralee General Hospital, or UHK as it's now known.
And why are you in there at the moment?
We are in the hospital 2 weeks today, actually, because Liam's symptoms at nighttime from the curvature of the scoliosis and what it's doing to his body physically is no longer able to be managed safely at home.
You obviously had growing concerns at your ability to manage Liam at home.
I did. It was 4 a.m. in the morning on the last Sunday before we came in here. And he was on my lap facing me, straddled across my lap so that I could get him to cough up what he was choking on. And I could no longer safely manage that at home. And I had been managing that at home since January the 1st of this year.
You're there now 2 weeks. What's the plan?
Liam has been managed in a way of trying to minimize the symptoms that he's having from the physical curvature of his spine. All we can do to alleviate that is, number one, we've changed his feeding routine. So basically, he's fed little and often. He went from 40 kgs before Christmas to 36 kgs in January. That's 4 kgs that he cannot afford to lose.
Gosh, it's traumatic even listening to what they're going through. Brian, if they had more supports at home, nursing supports, would it be the case that Liam wouldn't need to be in hospital in Tralee?
Well, I think if nursing hours were put in place at home, it would alleviate some of the burden on Pam, who is essentially nursing Liam round the clock with the help of staff. And she's very grateful for the staff in Tralee, which would, you know, she's having to ensure he doesn't choke at home. And that was why she had to make that decision to take him into Tralee. They have been promised some level of supports. They would help with the daily pain, with the discomfort Liam is in. But Pam says really the only remedy here is surgery, and she acknowledges surgery is high risk. With every week, Liam is losing weight and that surgery becomes more high risk. But she believes spinal fusion, it's the only way for him to reclaim some of his life back.
Last night, he had 2 silent choking episodes on fluid. And there is no more that we can do. Like even if I had a nurse at home, I'm here because if something awful happens, they can resuscitate, they can give oxygen and they can use suction. We are here because we are at the end of the road of what can manually be done to keep Liam well and safe and alive.
Is there a concern, Pam, that an operation like this for somebody like Liam could be life or death, basically?
It is really like the operation itself isn't something any parent would want to be shouting to get because it is very intense, very extreme. He's a complex care child. We have gone through the process of pre-op. We did that in February in Temple Street. So we spent a week in Temple Street where we did a week of pre-op tests.
Nobody has said to you, we're not going to do this surgery, it's too high risk.
Nobody has. No, we actually got the, it's the opposite. Everybody basically on the team is happy to go ahead.
What do you want at this point?
I want them to bring him in and give him surgery, because I've already been told that because he's now gone to 85 degrees and above, it potentially has now become two surgeries where they will do a surgery and 2 weeks later they will have to go in again. And the worry with that is they're struggling to give him a date for one surgery. How are they planning on giving him two? In the last 3 days in the hospital here, he's become rigid to lift. And I mean rigid. It was always painful. So it's getting to the point where he's going to become so unwell that I'm also afraid that, number one, that they're going to say he's inoperable. Number two, that he'll become so malnourished that he won't be able to face that surgery. Number three, that he could pick up an infection inside here. He should not be inside in the hospital.
That's Pam talking to Brian O'Connell on Today with Claire Byrne this morning about the challenges being faced by her 13-year-old son Liam as he waits for spinal surgery. On the day that the government issued a formal apology to the families of the Stardust victims, Joe Duffy spoke on this afternoon's Liveline to firefighter Joe O'Brien about the events of February 1981.
I was in the North Strand Fire Station at that time, Joe. And as we start, I just want to say this is, it's my recollection. I'm not here to speak for any of the lads or for the fire brigade. It's just my recollection of the night. And, you know, when we turned out on the night, Joe, Kilbardic had arrived just ahead of us. They were the first attending appliance. And those lads were going about their business as we pulled into the car park area. And it was absolutely pandemonium. I remember looking up at the roof and seeing that the fire had vented the building through the roof in two different locations. And my immediate kind of feeling was, sure, it's that well established a fire at this stage, surely everybody is out.
Okay.
Little did I know what we were to encounter.
And reminding people that the roof, the Stardust, was a converted factory. It wasn't a purpose-built public venue. It was a converted factory, and the roof was a factory roof. Those apexed with the valleys and the apexes, and I presume it was just corrugated. So the flames were coming through the corrugated iron or whatever. The flames were coming through the roof, and you presumed at that stage the fire is so involved that everyone would have exited. But that, when did you realise that was not the case?
Well, immediately when we pulled up at the exits, Joe, we could see that there were still people coming out of them to our left as we approached the building. And we approached the building then and parked to the right of the building as we drove down the forecourt of the car park. And then we realised, look, there's still people in here. And the lads from Kilbarrick number 6 station, as we called them. Mm-hmm. The lads from number 6 were already getting down to work. They had already seen the immediacy of what was required, and they were in the building effecting rescues and getting people out, you know. So we joined in that at that stage. And I didn't fully realise the number of people who are still in the building, because although the fires do, if you like, they're dynamic scenarios and they happen very, very quickly. They're very unpredictable in the way they can, if you like, engulf a building. But given that the roof space in the Stardust was a common roof space, there was no compartmentation or separation in it to contain any fire in the immediate zone or area. So it just spread across the roof. And I know I jumped the gun a little bit here maybe, but the narrative, Joe, as you're well aware, at the time was that this fire was arson, that, you know, some of the kids at the disco had started this fire. But the fire was that well involved when we arrived. My feeling always was that the fire had come down from the ceiling. I had that feeling about it, that the fire had dropped down from the ceiling onto that infamous seated area.
Yeah.
And that's where it started, in the seated area, instead of anybody physically setting a match or a lighter to it, that the fire had fallen down from the ceiling, which was in fact the roof area or the roof space where the fire was fully involved. And that was my impression after the fire, thinking about it, how the hell did it? And then listening to the survivors and their accounts of getting out and the intense heat that they experienced from above them. You know, that always kind of confirmed for me what I felt was a probable cause, whatever wording you want to use. So for the thing to come out in the end, Joe, and last week when you were talking about it, then you kept using the phrase about the unlawful killing, you know, it really kind of drove it home to me, and I said to myself, well, you know, that appears to have been the way that, for me, the right way the whole thing came about. Okay.
Firefighter Joe O'Brien talking about his memories of the night of the Stardust tragedy with Joe Duffy on this afternoon's Liveline. Today is publication day for You Are Here, David Nicholls' new novel. The best-selling author of One Day spoke to Oliver Callan this morning about his new book and the ever-present presence of his most famous work.
Did that loom over you while writing You Are Here?
I didn't. I had a certain distance from the Netflix One Day. I wrote one episode and I was an exec producer, but I tried to keep my head down and get on with the novel. And yeah, it's sort of always there with everything I write, really. I love One Day. I'm very proud of it.
And yes.
I'm sure I'll always be author of One Day, David Nicholls, and that's great. I don't mind at all. At the same time, you know, this book is a sort of development. It's kind of, it's the next stage of life. It's a slightly more of a chamber piece, more of a mellow novel, a more mature novel. I can see that it complements One Day while at the same time being different.
It's interesting to hear you say that you think you'll always be seen as One Day author, David Nicholls.
Yeah.
Will that devalue some of the work? You've done a lot of work since then, of course. It's 2009, the novel comes out. Are you worried at all, though, that it almost devalues everything that comes later?
No. No, I mean, genuinely not. I really love it, and it brings a readership to the new books. And, you know, I think the new books are much, much better written. I much prefer You Are Here to One Day. But I'm also very, very, very fond of that book and very, very grateful for the security it's given me and the audience it's brought for me. And very grateful also to everyone who made the show, because that was such a brilliant experience for me as a novelist to see, feel that it was in good hands and to enjoy the process.
Mm. You think your work is better since? How better?
I just am a little bit more careful with the editing process, a little bit more thorough. I take my time a little bit more. I just feel a little bit... I suppose you grow up and you learn things along the way as a writer. You never quite learn how to do it. It always presents challenges. But I think I've become a bit cannier about technique and a bit more careful sentence by sentence. And I'm very proud of those later books as well, and very happy for that One Day brings a readership to those as well.
Well, we say later books, but you're not exactly an elderly gent of literature at this stage.
No, listen to me talking about my oof.
I'm just one reader now, but I did sort of dread the task initially because I don't think I'm a romantic story enthusiast.
Yeah.
But I really, really enjoyed this story because it's not really, you know, there's a lot more to it just than romance. There's a lot of stuff about family in here. It's a lovely walk with your characters going coast to coast or cover to cover as we do, mostly because it's very funny.
Yes, thank you. I mean, I did put a lot of work into making sure that it's definitely the funniest of them, I think. I mean, it is shot through with this kind of melancholy and sadness, and both Michael and Marnie, you know, are carrying a lot of emotional baggage, is the cliche, isn't it? But it's literal in this book. They're carrying the weight of these failed relationships, and they're both in a bad place when they start the walk. And yet, I did want it to be hopeful and joyous. And Marnie, in particular, is a very witty character.
Yeah.
The great thing about writing fiction is you can take your time and you can make the characters as witty as you like because you have years and years and years to polish their dialogue and their jokes. And I loved writing Marnie. I loved her her view of the world, her cynicism and her spark.
She's 38 years old. She's just been separated from a rotter of a fella.
Yeah.
But she is so funny. I mean, I absolutely loved Marnie as well. She's even trying to come up with a joke at one stage during sex.
Yes. Yeah. I should one day write a sex scene that's just completely deadpan, serious and erotic. And this isn't it. This is her distracted, trying to be in the moment, but distracted by the Radio 3 arts review programme that's playing in the background, not quite in the moment.
And someone in the B&B slipping notes under the doors and so on.
Yes, yes.
So how did Marnie manage to live inside your head?
I spend a long time writing the characters' biographies and thinking a lot about their tone of voice and their physicality and their background and what they wear and what they read and what they love. And I do a lot of sketching before I actually write the character in the official document. I don't write chapter one until there's about 20 or 30,000 words worth of notes.
So really?
I, it's a bit like preparing for a play, I guess. You know,
yeah.
You do all that preparation and make sure the character is rounded, and then you place them in the situation, and then it's much easier to write. I don't discover character as I go. I know who they are fully formed before I tell the story.
And Michael, the character, I mean, he's a difficult character, I would imagine, when you're putting it down on paper. How are people going to like this character? Because you could become fed up with just his sadness.
Yeah, he's been through a lot, and he's a little bit bruised. His relationship, his marriage is broken up. He's still in love with Natasha, his perhaps soon to be ex-wife. There are various things in his past that he's carrying with him. Definitely in the first draft, it was almost like funny chapter, sad chapter, funny chapter, sad chapter. And my very brilliant editor said, you know, can we make Michael a little bit warmer, a little bit funnier and Ryan kinder? So I think he has a certain self-awareness, and Marnie brings him out of himself and makes him laugh again and changes his view of the world. And it's in that sense, it's a very traditional love story. I like the idea of a conversation bringing people to the surface and allowing them to open up and reveal more of themselves as the walk goes on.
And one of the ways you kind of he makes fun of himself is the fact that he's a geography teacher and lives up to every stereotype imaginable
as they
set off on this long walk together with friends that leave eventually the two of them together.
Yes, they set out it's meant to be a group walking weekend, and Michael is intending to walk the coast to coast, which is a very famous, beautiful walk from St. Bees Head in Cumbria to the Yorkshire coast. And he wants to just get rid of everyone. But Marnie, for various reasons, tags along. And as the walk continues, I like the idea that you can map a relationship literally. So each of the chapters begins with the map that corresponds to that day's walking. And as the days pass, their relationship changes and they gradually reveal themselves to each other.
It's quite lovely and delicate, and we get very emotionally involved with these characters because of the way it's so cleverly mapped out. You're wondering, because she's constantly speculating we are dropping out, isn't she? She's supposed to leave at any moment.
Marnie is a Londoner. She's one of those Londoners who rarely steps out in the rain. She works at home. She's become quite antisocial. She's wonderful and full of jokes and life, but she's become a little bit shy and introverted. And she's very, very, very sceptical about the whole idea of nature and landscape. I didn't want to write... If you write a book about two people who love walking, going on a walk, there's nothing really to write about. There's no friction. So for a lot of it, Marnie really, really doesn't want to be there. But as the days go by, she changes and relaxes into it and loves it. And it's something I love too, so it was easy to write that passion.
So there's the yearning that they both have is basically the hope, isn't it, that this is not going to end miserably, hopefully, for these characters, or we're not hanging out with two miserable characters because they still want to live.
Yeah, it's initially about two people who've kind of given up on the idea of romantic love and have found ways, or are trying to find ways, to be by themselves in a way that's sustainable and happy and not miserable. I didn't want solitude to be the enemy. It is a book about loneliness, but I didn't want, you know, often with romantic comedies, it's the worst thing that can possibly happen to you, not being in a romantic relationship. And I wanted to be a little bit more positive about that. So Marnie in particular has found a way to throw herself into her work and into books and to be happy. And at the same time, both of them are holding out for the possibility of change, of meeting someone else and of leading a different life.
One Day author David Nichols talking to Oliver Callan about his new book, You Are Here, this morning. The book is published by Scepter. New research from the UK confirms what many of us have suspected for some time. Parking spaces are not big enough to accommodate modern cars. This morning, Claire Byrne was joined by Michael Sheridan, motoring journalist, and Simon Wall, former Westport Town architect and senior architect in Mayo County Council, to discuss car parking problems and the problems of cars in towns and cities in general.
So, Michael, have you ever had to crawl out of the boot to escape the car?
I've had to crawl out of the boot. I've had to do the old crawling over the centre console. And, you know, just to paint a picture for people, I'm a full-sized adult. By that, I mean, you know, I've grown and exceeded expectations for maybe my silhouette. So hopping across the centre console, you know, putting your back out, your shoulder goes half dislocated. Then you've got one foot trapped and then you're trying to get into the passenger seat. Then you literally fall out the passenger door and you get out of the car and you brush yourself down. And then you see the crowd with their phones videoing.
Yes, you, as and you pretend nothing unusual has
happened. It's a nightmare, but I had a joyous experience this morning because I'm so paranoid about where I park because of car sizes and reducing car spaces that I parked beside a hedgerow. So my driver's door was beside that. So I knew that nobody would be able to pull in beside me and stop me getting in and out of the car like a rock star.
Yes.
I was just going to be able to go up and know I can get into my car and not be terrified that I'd be boxed in and would have had to crawl through the boot or worse still, do a half an hour of stretching before I could try and attempt going in from the passenger.
But listen, this is a real issue, isn't it?
Because
cars
issue.
Are much bigger now than they were.
They are. They're huge. And as the survey said, everything has been growing by about a centimetre every 2 years. The life cycle of a car is designed and built for maybe 8 years. Midway through that, it gets a facelift, which usually means new bumpers, new lights, just to freshen it up. But essentially, it's the same bit of engineering underneath. With the adoption of more safety aids, the demand for more interior space to be able to fit adults in the back of cars, to be able to fit three adults comfortably in the back of cars with safety belts, with airbags and all this sort of thing, and to still have a functioning boot, a boot that can work for families that can take a big shop and they can take a travel cot or take a buggy. God knows the size of buggies that people have to carry, travel systems to give them their full name in boots these days. So the demand from consumers is for larger cars.
Mm-hmm.
And the car companies, they're not doing this for the good of their health. They will sell us everything they can and they will try and maximise profit. Big cars make more profit for them. Smaller cars are very hard to make profitably. So
We're
all being pushed in this direction. But yet, consumers are demanding bigger cars. Spaces don't seem to have gotten any bigger.
Prepared to crawl out in a very
Absolutely.
Embarrassing way. Now, Simon, listening to all of this, and as I said, former Westport Town architect and senior architect in Mayo County Council. So the cars are growing, but what you did in Westport was you pushed back against that, really, because you have reduced the number of parking spaces on the main streets in Westport to about half of what they were. Is that right?
Well, it wasn't quite half, but yes, Claire, cars are certainly getting bigger in our towns, more dominant in our streetscapes and within our public realm, which is the public space between the buildings within our towns. Now, local authorities can't really change the growth of cars because people choose this by freedom of choice through purchase. And I suppose the car size debate can polarise people both locally and nationally. However, what we did in Westport over 20 years, we embraced both big and small car owners to encourage less use of their cars. And we did this by making towns more walkable and livable. So getting people out of cars, what the technical people would call modal shift, to make the right choices. And us as local authority executives did judicious management of the public realm through a palette of really positive solutions. And just before I get into the solutions, I'd like to talk about really the town square and the public realm. Historically, the town square in an Irish rural town was the living room of the town. If the town was a building or a house, the town square was its living room. They were great places for social discourse, markets, political gatherings for people like Michael Collins and Dev on the back of horse carts. And they heralded in, I suppose, the foundation of our state. But since the demise of the rural Irish town from, say, the 1960s and the 50s onwards, of many of them, the main public squares, these cultural entities in the town centre have been relegated to, I suppose, the cultural presence of a supermarket car park.
Mm-hmm.
They've been covered in tarmac and white lines. So what we tried to do is reverse that and enhance the public realm by a series of interventions.
But it's interesting, Simon, that you know you don't sound anti-car. Like, you accept that people want to drive cars and they want to drive these bigger cars that Michael described so well a little earlier. It's just where they put them. That's the issue.
That's true, but I also want to give people the choice of not using their car. Inside every car is a pedestrian with a full metal jacket just dying to get out and walk down a lovely streetscape. And that's really what we're trying to do. So we try to, I suppose the first thing we did in Westport is we acquired a lot of the backlands, brownfield sites, to create car parking spaces. So it allowed us to take car parking away from the main streets, our historic cores like the Octagon and the Clock area, and really put in interventions instead of car parking spaces for sitting down, for trees, for sculpture, for outdoor dining. And in doing that, we have all of 50% of the car parking in Westport is in the backlands and 50% is in the streetscape. If we didn't acquire those lands in the backgrounds, we couldn't have freed up the streetscape to make nice pedestrianized spaces. So that was a really important thing in terms of our strategy for the town, which we kind of established around the year 2000. Mm-hmm. And the other thing then is creating what's been very positive for us is parklets, creating outdoor dining. Instead of a car parking space, you may have a small cafe. It can double its table size or its table units by having an outdoor space outside the building instead of a car parking space. And especially on a sunny day, obviously on a rainy day, it doesn't work as much. But and COVID has really pushed that as well. And people in shops are beginning to realize the value of the car parking space doing something else outside your shop, which probably they didn't recognize the value of that, say, 20 or 30 years ago.
Yeah, well, if you hadn't seen it up to that point, you wouldn't know what that space could be used for. So, Michael, listening to all of that, all of these people in the big cars, do they just want to throw them up on the footpath in the centre of town?
Absolutely, because they're clearly maniacs and they hate society. It's funny, while what sounds in Westport, it sounds ideal and it sounds lovely, you know, the notion of cafe society and being able to stroll around the place and having a heart of a town. It is essential and it's very, very important. But the reality of having to get kids around the place, to unfold buggies, to load shopping, to do this and the other, we really have to be realistic and say people want to be able to move their family around or move in vehicles of their choice, and that's just the way it is now. These spaces are lovely, but we have to ensure that we don't penalise people who don't necessarily want to stroll or who have to assemble a stroller to put the twins into it. The toddler's trying to run away and you've got to get them in and you've got to carry this and you've got to go and pick up a flat screen TV to bring home that you've been trying to get into your car for mm-hmm. ages.
Motoring journalist Michael Sheridan and Mayo County Council senior architect Simon Wall discussing the problem of huge cars in tiny parking spaces in small to medium towns and cities on this morning's Today with Clare Byrne. On this afternoon's Ray Darcy show, who showed up in studio? Only Daniel O'Donnell himself. Here's a little taster of their conversation.
How do you stay interested? Because we were talking to Jeremy Irons yesterday, there's a bit of name dropping, Oscar winner, and he was saying that in his 50s there he got bored with acting, and so you've been doing it, the first time you got on stage it was over 40 years ago.
It was. And maybe before that, I suppose, but and the kind of, if you call it professional, was with Margaret in 1981, should I say, and I just enjoy the singing. You know, I just enjoy singing and I enjoy the fun with the audience and the stage and I just enjoy it. I that's all I can put it down to is the enjoyment. I don't get bored.
You don't get bored?
No.
And I was reading a review of one of your shows in Australia and they were saying that you're funnier now. But that comes with age, does it? Been more comfortable
maybe
in your skin.
Starved of humour.
Is that it? No, you're a very funny man. There's always mischief in your eye. That's the thing about you, Daniel O'Donnell. Then the other thing is that you seem to be including little, like you use videos.
Yeah,
for
we
example.
Do use videos. Yeah. I suppose that's the kind of how things progress, and it's there, it's available, and you can do more things. And you know, you have everybody has videos of personal things that they can.
So you play out your late mother.
Yes, you know, my mother wrote a poem about OE Island, where she was from. It's called My Lovely Island Home. This was way back in the 70s when the last people left the island, the islanders. And she wrote this poem so that people would never forget the island and the life that they had. And then in the late 90s, when I was doing the album of songs that I had written with other people, I said to my mother, I says, "Mom, we'll have a look at the poem." So we looked at the poem and I wrote a wee chorus for it and, you know, sang it. I don't write music. I can't read music or write music, but I sang it as I heard it. So right. Then recorded it. And we had her reciting the poem, you know, so which is great to have.
Why did you have that? Where did it come
because
from?
Because we used it somewhere.
Right.
You know,
yeah,
we just
yeah.
took a video of her. I think she was on a Christmas video I was doing and we put it on it just to
yeah,
have it.
Yeah.
And then when after she passed away, we were putting together a show and I thought we'll do the lovely. I'd sung My Lovely Island Home and it was my niece actually said, "We have Granny saying it," you know. So she starts it saying the first verse and then I come in singing.
Lovely.
And it works nice because, you know, it's a story.
It's a duet with you and
your kind
your late
of, yes.
Mom. I've seen it's her 10-year anniversary now in a couple of
yes,
weeks.
Yes, and yes.
Is that any different to the 9th anniversary?
Well, it's amazing that it's that long, you know, because it's 10 years, but it doesn't seem like 10 years since we didn't hear her saying something or instructing you to do something. It's how the time has passed. But she had a great life, you know, my mother. She lived a great life.
She was 94.
She would have been 95 in the July and she died in May. And, you know, we were lucky to have her in very good health for most of her time. Maybe the last year was...
But that's 93 yeah, good years.
Yeah, she had... Yeah.
You have the good genes as well.
I hope so.
Yeah, I hear you're hopping up and down off stages in the current show.
Well, I might be hopping cautiously now.
Right.
I used to just throw caution to the wind, but now I look to see where I'm going to hop and then I hop.
Is there a jumpsuit involved as well?
Ah, no, there's nothing like that.
I thought you're not doing Elvis jumpsuit.
No, there's no jumpsuit. No, it's just a kind of a jeans and a leather jacket.
Oh, right,
know.
Okay. Which Elvis?
That's even a stretch.
Which Elvis? Stretch jeans. Which,
yeah.
Which Elvis song do you sing?
I sing a wee selection with Love Me Tender and All Shook Up.
Yeah.
Blue Suede Shoes and... There's another one too.
Have you
Her
seen the movies?
She's Not You, I think.
Have you seen the movies? Have you seen both the movies?
I saw the last one, the Elvis.
Yeah,
yeah.
Then
yeah.
there's Priscilla as well.
No, I didn't see that yet.
Interesting.
No.
We just watched it over the weekend because it, you know, you come away from it with a different view of Elvis. You know, because it's from her point of view.
Okay.
He was a bit controlling. This is his depiction in the movie.
Right.
He had anger issues. Obviously, and then he was giving her drugs when she was underage, that sort of thing, you know. It's an ugly side of it, but you can't argue with the music, can you?
Yeah, well, I suppose Elvis was a great singer, and I don't know that he gets the credit for how good he was. If you listen, especially to his gospel stuff, you see, a lot of Elvis's stuff was rock and roll, and it moves along,
yes,
you
yeah.
know, but or in the ghetto, if you hear him singing in the ghetto, it's magnificent.
That's wee Daniel singing the praises of Elvis on this afternoon's Ray Darcy Show. Finally, on this edition of Playback Daily, another thing that successive governments have promised to improve, but, shock horror, haven't, is the issue of childcare costs. On This Morning's Today with Claire Byrne, a panel of contributors looked at the cost of childcare in other countries. Here, for example, is Maya Oppenheim, women's correspondent with The Independent UK and author of The Pocket Guide to the Patriarchy, on what it's like in the UK.
So there is free childcare provision supplied by the government, but, you know, it's one of those things, it sounds a lot better on the tin than it is in reality. The childcare system in this country is chronically underfunded. Lots of nurseries are closing their doors. So trying to access free childcare supplied by the government is very difficult in reality. There's basically an affordability and an accessibility crisis. The UK is one of the most expensive childcare systems in the world. You know, for many women and parents, it makes no financial sense to work.
So does that mean then that a lot of parents are forced into private arrangements and can't avail of those state supports?
Yes, essentially. Basically, yeah. I mean, the childcare crisis in this country, it's a long, long enduring one, and it's entrenching gender inequality. It's pushing women out of the workplace due to them often taking on the lion's share of childcare.
Mm-hmm. There's an extraordinary figure that says 85% of mothers struggle to find childcare that fits around their work, leading to many of them having to leave the workplace.
Yeah, that is, yeah, as women's correspondent, you know, this is an issue I write about a lot. I've interviewed tons of mothers who've, you know, been, you know, they're either contemplating leaving work, they've left work, you know, increasing numbers of parents are racking up debt to fund childcare costs, and also growing numbers of women are having abortions as they can't afford to have kids.
So as we're coming up to an election, obviously we don't know quite when it's going to be in the UK, but it is imminent. Is it on the political agenda?
Yes, it is. Well, historically, childcare has been an issue that's long been overlooked and neglected in this country, but it has massively climbed the political agenda in recent years, but still where near enough attention is given to it. But Jeremy Hunt, he declared a new childcare. He unveiled a major expansion of free childcare to attract voters last year. But there's been loads and loads of issues with how it's being rolled out in reality.
Mm-hmm. It's one thing, as you said at the beginning, to say this is what we offer. But unless the places are there and the childcare services are staffed properly, it's pointless to have those policies in place.
Totally. People end up being, you know, bitterly disappointed parents. You know, they make plans to, you know, go back to work and then they can't actually do that in reality when they realise, you know, those headlines that they saw are not quite what they seem. But yeah, the childcare sector is in a really fragile, volatile state.
Claire also spoke to journalist Helen Russell, author of How to Raise a Viking, The Secrets of Parenting the World's Happiest Children. And Helen told her what childcare is like in Denmark.
Kids are guaranteed a place in high-quality local government-run nursery from 6 months old, and that's 75% subsidised by the government. They will stay in that nursery usually until they are around three, and then they'll move into a kindergarten from age three till age six. They don't start school till age six in Denmark. And again, that's 75% subsidised. So as a result, 80% of mothers work, and it's still a cost, but it's far, far lower. So I have three small children. I paid for the nursery around €450 a month, and then for the kindergarten part around €330 a month. Mm-hmm. And if you have a second child, it's half price for the second child. So yeah, it's a pretty good system.
And there's a really important cultural distinction to point out as well, where it is accepted across the board that this is what happens, this is what you do, you go back to work and your childcare place is there and available for you.
Absolutely, and there isn't that same parental guilt. It almost feels like a luxury in much of the world now to think, oh, will I stay at home with my child or will I go back to work when the economic necessity is that you often need two incomes there. But in the Nordic countries, it's much more the norm. Post-World War II, there was this emphasis on getting women in the workplace to get women's taxes to contribute to this welfare state that we all hear about from the Nordic countries. And having high-quality childcare just became the norm and the necessity. And so culturally, it's very accepted that that's what children do. And they all seem to thrive on it. I've only had quite good experiences of this.
And in all of the other places we've spoken to, we've heard about the staffing crisis, you know, very difficult to hire and to retain staff. Is that an issue there?
There are still, I would say that they are more highly respected. They do a BA, they are highly trained, but there's still issues that more and more are being asked to do more paperwork and more admin, for example, and then that time comes away from the children. And there has been a kind of dispute in the media over recent years about whether there are enough adults in the place and whether there is enough grown-up care around there, but generally it's a lot better than elsewhere. I think many would say they would like to be paid more, but it's not as bad as elsewhere.
To get the lowdown on the state of childcare in Ireland, Claire turned to Irish Independent news correspondent Ellen Coyne. Spoiler alert, it's not good.
Unfortunately, for a lot of parents in Ireland, having childcare is not only the equivalent to a mortgage payment. If you have more than one child, it can actually be the same as a salary, and it doesn't make a lot of economic sense for some women to go back to work at all. The Irish Independent did a survey run by six of my colleagues that found that there are around 35% of childcare places in Ireland have no spaces available for children at all. The highest childcare fees can be €1,500 a month if you're in South Dublin. It's almost impossible to get a baby room because they tend to be more expensive to run. So if you can't afford to take a full year's maternity leave, you could be left stranded with no childcare whatsoever. And for mothers who maybe want to try to work part-time once they have small children, that can be very difficult as well, because around a third of childcare providers will expect parents to pay for a full 5 days, even if they only use two or three.
Yeah, so you just can't get a part-time place.
You just can't do it.
And there are some parts of Ireland where trying to get a baby looked after is impossible. You just can't do it.
Yeah, and the reason is because those rooms tend to be more expensive to run. For obvious reasons, baby rooms require a higher ratio of staff. Mm-hmm. So a lot of creches will actually only start providing childcare from the time the baby is aged one, which proves very difficult to people who aren't in a position to take a full year's maternity leave beyond that statutory 26 weeks.
You see, it's really interesting talking to Helen about what's happening in Denmark with this accepted cultural norm that when your baby is 6 months old, your child will go into childcare, which is provided for by the state and heavily subsidised. That is the norm, and it is obviously supported and paid for by every taxpayer. That's not the case here.
Exactly. And I think you've hit the nail on the head there. It's not just a difference in terms of state funding and state intervention and subsidies. It's actually an ideological difference. Like, going back to work after maternity leave can be difficult enough anyway, without the scramble to find a place. And then the struggle to kind of think, is this economically the best choice for your family if the cost of childcare is so high? Mm-hmm. And another really important trend that's emerging in Ireland, that's actually been accepted by Roderick O'Gorman, the children's minister himself, is that the cost of childcare is so high now, it's actually influencing family planning. Parents are trying to stagger the gap between the first child and a second child to avoid paying over €2,000 a month in childcare, which carries, unfortunately, the inherent risk of putting off having a baby and then potentially struggling when you do decide to try to get pregnant again. So when you're talking about things like that, shaping a family's destiny, you know, a woman's ability to go back to work, your decision to have the size family that you want, you're talking about a real break in the social contract there. So I'm not surprised that so many politicians are bringing this up at their ordesh and are already looking towards the next election and the next budget, because for a lot of households in Ireland, this is their number one issue.
Number one, two and three in some cases. That's Irish Independent news correspondent Ellen Coyne talking to Claire Byrne this morning about how Irish childcare compares to other countries. And that's all I have for you on this edition of Playback Daily. The programme was compiled, written and edited by me, Neil O'Sheridan. Don't forget, you can listen back to all the programmes featured on Playback Daily on the RTE Radio app. Until the next time, thank you for listening and good luck.